Then we study one particular 3D process, namely the plus and minus interpolation for means. So
this, I guess, there are two reasons why I choose to talk about this particular process. The main reason is that it's treated in Peskin and Schroeder. The second reason is that this is probably the most simple, technically the most simple QED amplitude that one can compute. And it is useful, in accelerator experiments, this process is used as a sort of normalization scale to, especially in the electron-positron colliders, which some time ago the most powerful collider was of this type. This was the process that they used for calibration, so that every cross section of production of other type of particles was calibrated using this muon production. And so it's easy to calculate the amplitude, and we'll go through this calculation step by step. So muons are relatively heavy particles, so they're much heavier than electrons. So their mass is 106 GeV, whereas electron mass is 0.511 MeV. So there is a difference by a factor of 2,000, yes?
Not any particular name. So, yeah, annihilation, electron positron annihilation.
The simplicity of this process. So this process is simplest because there is just one Feynman diagram that contributes to the leading order. The electrons, electron and positron annihilate each other. They produce a virtual photon, which then recreates the muon anti-muon pair. So we can study the case where electron in the initial state has four momentum P and spin S. Positron has four momentum P prime and spin S prime, and the same for muons. So that would be K prime and R prime. The qualitative features of this reaction can be understood without calculations. Yes?
Exactly like an electron is heavier.
Yes, I forgot to say that. Muons, as far as electromagnetic interactions are concerned, muons are twin brothers of electrons, if you have said this.
So the Lagrangian of QED would be supplemented by something exactly like QED but with a different mass?
That's right, yes. Okay. You just had another term for muons, and described by the Dirac Lagrangian. Yes. So there is another. It is assumed that we had another field to the Lagrangian that describes muons.
Yes. There's no interaction, just proton electron muons.
No, because this is not forbidden by symmetry indeed, but by QD symmetries. But so the number of muons and electrons is separately conserved. So that's why the electron can become muon by meeting a photon. Yes.
Interaction part of the Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian is the thing we need to calculate all this actually which was done, right?
Yes.
So when we have it, we can go through the calculations. But how do we know what the interaction term looks like? How do we know that we should have something like this to take into account, for example, this kind of a interaction?
Well, that's given from the beginning, right? So we study this particular theory, which is QED. So we have our Lagrangian is minus quarter F mu plus psi electrons phi minus n electron psi electron, and then the same Lagrangian for muons. So, and then the interaction terms, minus E A mu, and I don't know, let's take this into brackets, because this mu is not the Lorentz index. Sin electron, and then minus E A mu psi bar mu.
So this is the Lagrangian we are going to study. Should look like that.
Well, in this particular case, there are several reasons. So one is symmetry. So this is the simplest Lagrangian we can write that will be invariant in the gradient transformations, phase transformations of the fields. In fact, this is the unique Lagrangian that contains only marginal directors. In other terms, the operators will have higher dimension and will be suppressed by some energy scale, which must be very high. And therefore, we can neglect it when we are feeling these processes happening at low energies. So this is one reason. The other reason is that, is analogy with classical physics. So in classical physics, we know that electromagnetic potentials interact with currents, so the interaction energy is current times A mu. And so, and we know what are the currents for the Dirac fermions, so we just had the term A times the current of electrons plus A times the current of muons. Okay, then we also know that electrons experimentally, that electrons and muons have the same charge. So this is basically the only Lagrangian we can work on. Now, of course, in some formal sense, that the whole
the main goal of particle physics is to write down the character of this character, particles and their interactions. So in this particular case, we assume that it is known, and then we can calculate the amplitude of the cross-section. So we will study this cross-section in the central mass frame. Incoming electrons. So in space-time, the process will look like that. So there is some collision axis along which electron and positron move before the collision with equal momentum, so that the total momentum is zero. Then they collide at some point. And out come mu and anti-mu. So in principle, they will move in the direction that makes some angle with the original collision axis.
So here is how the kinematics for this reaction look like. So various particles will have the following four momenta. So we can write the four momentum for the electron. Then for we know that the positron has the opposite momentum in the center of mass frame, therefore its energy is the same. The same is true for muons, and because of the energy conservation, the energy of the of each muon should be equal to the energy of the electron, right? So the total energy is conserved. The energies of each muon should be the same. So by energy conservation, the final state energies should be the same. And then the absolute values of momenta are determined by the usual relativistic relation, so that for muons, the energy is m squared plus p squared. Now for electrons, we will use the approximation where we neglect the mass. So let me explain why. So first of all, this reaction will not be possible always. So there will be a threshold, because and the electrons should have at least enough energy to produce muons at rest. So muons are heavy particles. It's necessary to inject enough energy to overcome the rest energy of the muon. So there is the threshold energy. So which is just the mass of the muon. So it is clear that if electron and positron move with the energy that's equal to the rest mass of the muon, then muons will be produced at rest. If they have smaller energy, then the reaction is impossible kinematically. And if they move with larger energy, then okay, then muons will fly apart with some non-zero velocity. Yes?
To the first expression for U, should that be k
squared? Yes, that should be k squared. Thank you. Now, you see that mass of the muon is 2,000 times larger than the mass of the electron. So even at threshold, the energy of the electron
is 2,000 times larger than its rest energy. Sorry? 200.
200.
Still a lot.
Yes, I guess it is 200.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. Anyway, so not only that, but so we can estimate what are the corrections to this approximation. I don't remember if we discussed that, but the sign of mass in the Dirac Lagrangian doesn't have any particular significance. One can do parity transformation, which will change the sign of mass. So parity interchanges left and right compound. So this field, one can see that this changes this sign here. So only mass square has a physical meaning and can, I mean, any observable quantity like cross section, et cetera, can depend on the mass square. So corrections will actually, the leading correction will be quadratic in the ratio. So correction due to finite electron mass will be of order m e squared divided by m mu squared, which is something like 10 to the minus 5. So up to this accuracy, we can neglect electron mass. In fact, since we do calculation to the leading order in perturbation theory, taking into account electron mass would be really a mistake, because there are corrections of order alpha, which is over 4 pi, right, which is 10 to the minus 3, which has 100 times, which are 100 times larger. So next order QED corrections are actually more important than the effective the finite mass of the electron. Okay, so what can we say about the cross-section of this process just from without the calculations? So can I erase? So first of all, the cross-section, the amplitude of this process will be proportional to this diagram. So the amplitude contains two vertices. It will be proportional to alpha, to e squared, which is proportional to alpha. Right, so alpha is squared divided by 4 pi. Cross-section is the square of the amplitude integrated over the space. So the cross section will be then proportional to alpha square. It will not be very deep because the coupling constant is small. So we know that it's proportional to alpha square. Now we can estimate how the cross section behaves at high energies by using simple dimensional analysis. Suppose that the energy is much larger than the muon mass. So the muon mass is the only scale in the problem that is left. Actually, there are two scales. There is the center of mass energy and the mass of the muon. And so by dimensional counting, the cross section should, when the cross section has dimension minus 2 in the units of energy,
the dimension of area, but in our units, area has dimension of 1 over energy squared. So the cross-section should be proportional to 1 of the scale squared. Now when E and M mu are of the same order of magnitude, you don't know what the scale is. But if you go to very high energies, you can forget about the muon mass, which is neglected, and then we know that the cross-section should
scale as some constant times alpha squared divided by E squared. So the cross-section should decrease as the square of energy at higher energies, and it should be zero below the mass of the muon. So its energy dependence should look more or less like that. There is some threshold at the muon mass. The cross section should start at zero, then grow, and then at high energies it decays as 1 over E squared. So our goal will be to compute this curve exactly, so just using the rules of quantum field theory. So for that we need to calculate this amplitude using Feynman diagrams and then to integrate over the phase space. And so to get the idea of the behavior of the cross section near the threshold, it's instructive to first do the phase space calculation. So there is a general formula for the two-particle phase space, right? So the phase space is equal to d3k over 2 pi cubed, d3k prime over 2 pi cubed, where these are three momenta of the outgoing muons. And then divided by 2 twice the energy of one of the muon and then twice the energy of the other muon times the four-dimensional delta function that ensures the conservation of energy and momentum in this reaction. Okay, so and then eventually we want to integrate the amplitude squared with this wave. But then we can immediately remove four integration variables here because of the four-dimensional delta function and leave just two leave just two variables not restricted by kinematics. So these two variables are actually angular coordinate of the outgoing muon. Okay? So actually when we consider this kinematical picture, we have already taken into account the condition imposed by this delta function. And so it makes sense to integrate over, one integration is just tells us that the three momenta of the outgoing muons are opposite.
So we can immediately integrate over k prime. And then we can integrate over the absolute value of the muon momentum, because it's also fixed by the delta function, right? So the k is fixed by the conservation of energy. We know that mu squared plus k squared is equal to the energy squared. We can immediately integrate phi over four-dimensional space fixed by kinematics. So, and that would be integral over k. So let's write a three-dimensional volume element in momentum space, then divided by 2e squared, and then the energy conservation delta function. Minus 2e. Okay, so there is a general rule how to integrate the delta function of some arbitrary argument. So we should divide by the derivative. We should set everything, the integrand, to the zero of the argument, and divide by the derivative with respect to integration variable. So this will be equal to so first of all, let's separate the angular integration. Then there will be a factor of 16 pi squared e squared. And then the integral over k dk k squared delta of 2 square root of k squared plus mu squared minus 2e. And then we can write this as 1 over 32 pi squared square root of 1 minus m mu squared over e squared times d omega, where this is the solid angle element in the direction of outgoing muon. So here is this picture again. We have two electrons colliding, and then the positive muon is going inside the solid angle. So we are computing the probability to find the outgoing muon in the solid element d omega. So this is the phase space for this muon to go precisely in this direction, right? So let me explain how these factors arise here. Well, we have e squared in the numerator. Then there will be a derivative of this function that will be also in the denominator. So that would give, the derivative is k divided by the square root. The square root is just the energy. So this would eliminate one factor of k and one factor of e. So what stands here is actually k divided by e. So this is the ratio of outgoing muon divided by its energy, which is nothing but the velocity of the muon. So you see that it is this factor that produces threshold suppression of the cross section. So it goes to zero a threshold. When muon is moving, is produced with zero velocity, the phase space shrinks to zero. Just because the phase space is a three-dimensional volume in the momentum space, and so if you are sitting precisely at the origin of momentum space, the phase volume shrinks to zero. So therefore, the threshold singularity is square root-like. So the cross-section will behave as a square root of energy minus the energy of the minus the threshold energy. So we know that here the cross section should behave as square root of E minus M mu. And then, okay, we can figure out from dimensional analysis that the factor should be well, alpha squared divided by E to 5/2, I think, right, by dimension. Yeah, that should scale as, in total, it should scale as 1 over E squared. So it's, if it, we took out one power, the square root of energy coming from the phase space, so the rest should scale as 1 over E to the 5/2. So these are the general features. So the cross-section starts at the square root at threshold, then it grows actually very quickly. And then in the most part of the energy interval, it just decreases at the second power of energy. Now let's calculate it from this diagram. So we need to find the amplitude that corresponds to this Feynman diagram. And so we just use the usual Feynman rules. The amplitude contains two vertices, which give the factor of minus I times E squared. And then, so there will be two factors associated with the fermion line. So let's first work out the initial electron fermion line. So we should work from the end of the line. So we start with the positron wave function. Then it is contracted with the gamma matrix in the vertex and with the electron wave function from the initial state times U S of P. Okay, then we have the propagator here. So the propagator is equal to minus I G mu nu divided by the momentum that flows through this line. And by momentum conservation, we see that this momentum that momentum of the carried by the photon is the sum of the momentum of initial particles. So in the denominator, we will have P plus P prime squared. And then we have a factor associated with the outgoing muons. So this is the again working from the end of the fermion line, we now start with the outgoing negatively charged muon. So this would be U bar of R K gamma nu, and then U of V of R prime K prime.
yes, these U's are not the same.
So strictly speaking, I should write some index here that telling that these are U's and these of electron, and these are U's and these are of the muon. So these are solutions of the Dirac equation with different masses. But since they depend on moment, it's clear that this there is no way to confuse the problem. Okay, so to find the probability and eventually the cross section, we need to square this matrix element and integrate it over the phase space. So the amplitude squared is
16 pi squared alpha squared. So I re-expressed E through alpha using the relation that alpha is E squared over 4 pi. Okay, so this denominator will give me P plus P prime to the fourth power. And then there will be product of some, spinor wave functions. So this will be V prime S prime P prime gamma mu U S of P. And then I should multiply by complex conjugate. So here I need to use an extra equation. So suppose I have, so you see that I have expressions, contractions of this type here. And so both external leg factors have this form. So this is this is some vector as a Lorentz, as far as its Lorentz transformations are concerned. And now to make the square of the amplitude, I need to, which is the product of the amplitude and its complex conjugate, I need to take a complex conjugate of this spinor contraction. So this is, if you write it explicitly, so specifying explicitly what is the Dirac conjugate here, then we can use just Hermitian conjugation, the fact that the Hermitian conjugation of the Dirac matrix is given by by multiplying it from the left and from the right by gamma zero, and so gamma zero by itself is Hermitian. We arrive at this expression. Then gamma zero squares to one, and one can see that this is just U bar gamma mu v. So what we do, we just interchange U and V, keeping the, and also interchange the bar. So now U appears with, this is the complex conjugation for such spinor expressions coincides with the usual Dirac conjugation inside the spinor product. Yes?
Here we use the fact that we are complex conjugating a number is the same as Hermitian conjugating a number, right? And then because we are changing from the second to third, the ordering of all the matrices.
That's right.
And so there we're using that the complex conjugate is actually also an Hermitian conjugate for a number, right?
Right. So this is a four-dimensional Coulomb, right? And this is four-dimensional row. So this is some matrix. So complex conjugation of the this matrix in the inset, so contracted with the Coulomb and the row, can be is the same as Hermitian conjugation of the matrix, and then the conjugation of vectors. So this is the result, and so we just multiply, for instance, this spin of convection by its conjugate. Notice that the spin here is the same, so the spin labels are just labels, so
they characterize our initial and final state, so they have some particular values. Whereas the indices, the Lorentz index here, is not a label that characterizes the state, but rather is contracted with another index of gamma. So therefore, when we multiply the two amplitudes, we should use two different sets of indices here. And then V S prime. Yeah, let me.
Yes, so let me call it down. And then this is multiplied by another structure like that. So this would be U bar R of K gamma. So here I had had an index that was contracted with the index in the fermion spin or product. K prime. And then complex conjugate of that. K prime. So this is the amplitude squared. And in principle, if one wants to study the scattering of polarized electrons, and if the spin of muons is registered, yes?
Why if we change the order in writing? Why do we have first P prime and then P prime and then K.
Let's see. Yes, so
a neighboring gamma matrix should be contracted.
Yeah, there's some mistake here. So let's see, so that should be conjugate to this, and this is correct. But here I wrote something wrong.
Should be URK, same way.
That's right.
Yes,
it should be URK. We should just write the first line the same and then the other just second just be first.
No, I think that's okay. So this is the original spinner contraction. Then I flip the order, right? So U goes first and gets a bar, and then have a gamma, and then V with the same arguments as here, but without a bar. Now here I flip the order, so V goes first, and then U goes last. So this is a pretty complicated expression. Then the polarized cross section is hard to compute. One needs to use explicit expressions for the Dirac matrices, explicit expressions for the solutions that we found in another day, for the spinners. However, oftentimes we are not interested in
these exclusive cross-sections. We are more interested in cross-sections that take into account several possible initial states and several possible final states. In particular, we can imagine that all of the muons are registered. So we have to sum over all of their possible spins. And the initial electron beams are not polarized. So we don't really know. So it depends on how they're prepared and how the electrons are produced. But typically, they're produced in such a way that the probability, so that they have no distinguished polarization. So the probability to find spin up and spin down electrons in the initial state are equal. So what we then need to compute is spin averaged inclusive cross section. So spin averaging means that we sum over initial spins, so S and S prime, but we weighted with the factor 1/2. So this takes into account that the total probability is equal to 1. So we have two possible spins, each appearing with the probability 1/2. On the other hand, when we are talking about inclusive cross sections, we simply sum over the final states with the weight 1. So we take into account all possible final states, and which means that we are just summing over the spin labels. The calculation, because then we can use the formulas for the Dirac matrices. So there is the spin sums in this sort of expressions can be done using so they can be expressed in terms of Dirac matrices. And then everything boils down to computing the traces of Dirac matrices. So how does it work? So we know that sum over spins of the solutions of the Dirac equation the reason is that these solutions form a complete basis of states with given momentum in the spinner space, right? So if we sum over all spins, then this should be equal to it's not precisely 1. Because they satisfy the Dirac equation, but they are equal to projector into the solutions of the Dirac equation of given momentum. Anyway, there is this sum rule for the spinner wave functions. That's the mass of the particle that we are dealing with. So for electron, we should put 0 here, and for muon,
we didn't label using these, but yeah.
That's true both for electrons and for muons. So it's just a property of the Dirac equations. And then summation over, for antiparticles, there is a similar formula. S prime, P prime, U R. Beta P prime is equal to P minus M alpha beta.
And then you see that we always have each of the wave functions appearing twice. So here we have us times us bar. So we can just replace them by, when we average our spins, we replace them by p plus m. The same as here. And then we can take v and bring it here. This will also be replaced by matrix. And the indices are contracted in such a way that we will get a trace. So finally, with these simplifications, we find that the spin averaged cross section amplitude squared is equal to 4 pi alpha prime divided by p plus p prime squared. And then the product of two traces. So gamma mu p gamma mu t trace gamma mu k should be a prime here. K minus mu gamma mu times k prime plus k.
Is this nu, the gamma nu, the same as our gamma alpha earlier?
Sorry, which one?
The gamma nu's, are they the same?
The gamma nu's are the same, so I kept.
Are the same as our gamma?
So this is gamma lambda, but okay.
Yeah.
And that also took nu in brackets because this is not an index, it's just.
So what's a prefactor? Is it alpha prime?
It's alpha. Alpha squared.
Is there a 4 prime on the bottom of the top?
Sorry?
You keep the p prime to the 4. You keep the prime on the bottom.
Let me see. So 16s become 4 because we divide by 4. So we have to be correct.
What about a pi?
Sorry?
A pi. It should be pi squared, right?
Should be pi squared. Okay.
So you use this spin sum formulae and also negative electron mass.
Sorry?
You've neglected the electron mass in this as well.
And I neglected the electron mass here. I suppose Lerner didn't do this calculation of the black. He used pencil paper. And so we know how to compute these traces. So the key formula here is that one quarter trace of gamma mu q minus m gamma mu q prime plus m. So these two traces are of this type. First is m equals 0. So this can be calculated using this trace technologies for the Dirac matrices, and the result is pretty simple formula in terms of the momentum. So then we use this formula, plug it in, contract the indices, collect all the terms together, and then here comes the result.
So this is the final answer for the amplitude written in terms of in the invariant form. So it's manifestly Lorentz covariant. But then we are interested in computing the cross-section in one particular frame. So we need to plug in the expressions for this four momenta. And then in the center of mass frame, we get even simpler expression. So this is 16 equals 16 pi alpha squared 1 plus m mu squared divided by e squared plus 1 minus m mu squared divided by e squared times cosine squared theta. Okay, so indeed this cross-section depends on the angle. You see that the forward production of mu going into the forward direction is enhanced compared to mu's going perpendicular to the to the reaction axis. But it's, on average, it's non-zero everywhere. And then we need to compute the, we can compute the differential cross-section, which is, well, we need to take the amplitude squared, divide by the kinematical factor, which is the relative velocity of electrons times their energy squared, and multiply by the phase space. So here is the formula for the phase space. This is the amplitude. Then this is a very simple expression, which is just, what is it? It must be 2 times energy of electron squared, right? This is e squared plus e squared, plus absolute value of p squared, which is 2e squared. So then we find the differential cross-section. And it indeed has the expected form. So you see that it has a square root singularity at the threshold. So it behaves as, I mean, it goes to zero as a square root of the distance from the threshold. Then at high energies, when we can neglect the muon mass, it goes to some constant divided by energy squared. A constant meaning that some number that depends on the angle. We also can compute the total cross section. So by integrating it So over d phi d theta, and then sine theta. So this is the element of the solid angle. So it's very easy to integrate such a simple function, which gives the total cross section equal to p alpha squared divided by 3 e squared, square root of 1 minus m mu squared over e squared, 1 plus m mu squared divided by 2 e squared. It's pi. Yes?
Why is it so the differential cross-section is bigger for small angles, right?
It's bigger for small angles. There are some explanations to that. It has to do with the helicity conservation. So it's very simple to explain the limit when mu is regarded to be massless, in which case the helicity has to be conserved. For massless particles, helicity is constructed, and then one can see this. Then these two factors can go away, and this is just 1 plus cosine squared. This dependence somehow follows from the helicity conservation. If you are interested in the details, there is a long explanation in the textbook. So, okay, so this is the result of, this is the final result. Usually, in particle physics, the cross sections are, there is a special unit for the cross section, which is called bar, and which is simply 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. So this cross section in the typical energy range where this section has a peak, this has the nanobar range, so it's 10 to the minus 9 bar, which is a typical QD cross section at this energy level, and which can be estimated from dimensional analysis. So this must be proportional to alpha prime, and it should scale as one of the energy squared. Okay, so I guess my time is over, and let me just summarize. So what summarize the this course. So I guess the message that I wanted to convey is that, first of all, that fields describe particles. So when we do quantum field theory, then we describe particles and their interactions. Then there are several types of relativistic fields. Of different spin. So there are scalar fields, Dirac fields, and electromagnetic fields. And in particular, the quantized electromagnetic fields and Dirac fields describe electromagnetic processes in the regime where quantum effects are important. And then there is a method to take into account interactions of quantum fields based on Feynman diagrams, which actually has a rather wide range of applications. The Feynman diagrams are useful not only in high energy physics, where it is a standard tool, but also in condensed matter and in statistical physics. And I would like to thank you all for participating in this course. Thank you very much. That's it.